Okay, so we can move into this second half of the afternoon, and one of the things that Ajahn Chah, in terms of his teaching and setting example, was that the say practicing. He really tried to make practice into everything that we were doing, whether we were monastics or lay people, and the so whatever work we were doing, or having work projects, or for anybody who's been in the monastery and spent some time here, you know that work forms a part of our daily life, so that, and we're encouraged to bring our mindfulness, our meditation, and our investigation of Dhamma into the ordinary things that we're doing. So that's very much a part of Ajahn Chah's teaching. So I just wanted to read a short bit. It's titled, Working is Dhamma Practice. Outside of the annual rains retreat period, various work projects were undertaken, most of which involved the building or repair of Sangha dwellings. Lack of funds determined that much of this work was performed by Sangha members, but even on occasions when the work could have been hired out, it was rare for Lumpa to give permission for that to be done. Work projects provided opportunities for strengthening the cohesion and harmony of the community through concerted effort on tasks that, unlike meditation, had tangible, measurable results. Working for the common good provided a jolt for monks overly concerned with their own welfare and increased the affection and sense of belonging that Sangha members felt for the monastery. Work projects were means by which Lumpa's disciples were encouraged to further develop those qualities of consistent effort and patient endurance that Lumpa believed to be vital to progress in meditation. Certainly, manual labor for many hours a day in high temperatures and stifling humidity, sustained by one simple meal a day, was not for the faint-hearted. Work projects gave monks the opportunity to practice mindfulness in more fluid situations, and afforded Lumpa the opportunity to monitor how well the monks could maintain their practice outside of the Dhamma hall. Most of the monks were used to hard physical labor in the rice fields. In later years, when the community had grown much larger, work projects gave a means by which young monks and novices could channel any surplus outgoing exuberance into useful activities. On certain projects, Lumpa would keep the monks working until late into the night, surrounded by hurricane lamps that were besieged by insects. Some monks worried that their meditation practice was suffering. Lumpa replied, "This is practice. As you work, look at your mind. How does it feel when I ask you to perform this kind of task? Practice doesn't mean evading things all the time. You have to come out and face up to their defilements so that you know what they're like. Once you've trained, then you have to climb up into the ring. In the future, you will see the fruits. But for the time being, don't blame or praise. Just do the work." Every now and again, a disgruntled monk might leave, but the vast majority trusted in Lumpa's judgment. Ajahn Liam was one of those who thrived during this kind of practice. During work projects, Lumpa emphasized giving up our own comfort and desires for the benefit of others. This kind of sacrifice is the dana, the giving of monks. It arises in a generous heart that considers the welfare of the community. In fact, there's plenty of time, but when we hurry, craving makes us feel that we're short of time. At Wat Bapong, we don't work with craving. We work in the spirit of self-sacrifice. We show how making sacrifices for the group is a beneficial Dhamma practice. So I think that's a good example for the, for all of us, in that, because oftentimes we bifurcate and split up. There's my work, and my Dhamma practice. There's my life, and then there's my meditation, and those things get split up. And Ajahn Chah was really keen to make sure that we didn't miss the reality that our Dhamma practice and our life, our responsibilities and our duties in the world are part and parcel of our training, and they are reflecting our mind all the time, and so that learning how to recognize that, because oftentimes we just want to, I don't like it, I don't want it, and we get away from this, and then we miss that opportunity to see it clearly. And so it is a part of our practice and training. Yeah, Rick.
Yeah, taking that theme, that's the question. Because something that I'm trying to work with there's just practice. Oh. And so it's like sometimes you talk about formal and informal practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done that. And part of my mind is trying to move away from that concept,
mm-hmm.
of formal and informal practice. It's just how I'm practicing in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And not really have to name it formal and informal. Because in the mind, it feels like then it does that division you just talked about.
Yeah. I mean, we tend to do that, and what it does is kind of we'll elevate one thing and diminish another, and in reality, we have to be investigating both or all.
Yeah, because I elevate sitting practice.
Yeah.
I'm doing sitting practice, so I can, when I'm not sitting, I'm still being pretty mindful as best as I can, so why not make one better than the other? It's just all life practice.
And yes and no, in the sense that sometimes people will, it's all practice, so I don't have to sit. I just need to be mindful in everything. But then what that usually means is we're not bothering to doing the sitting and making that effort to still the mind. So it's like Ajahn Chah would sometimes say, yeah, it's true, but it's not right. It's right, but it's not true. So it's sort of getting a balance, and so that. But definitely, the sense of really trying to integrate practice into everything, or integrate Dhamma understanding into everything that we're doing, whether it's taking on duties and responsibilities, or it's sitting meditation and with our legs crossed and whatnot, but that, and then there's a continuity that, because that's actually one of the aspects of the cultivation of the path is there's this quality that's where the path comes together in harmony, and then there is no separation, so that the whole path of sila, samadhi, panya, of right view, right intention, through to right samadhi, all come together in a harmonious, integrated way, And that's and in the Pali they call it Magga Samagi, so that the path in unity or in harmony. Well, I mean, one of it's, I mean, you always want to be investigating, you investigate suffering, and that's it, using that as a reflective point. And then, especially in taking apart, say, thought processes or underlying assumptions, it's sort of investigating, recognizing how it trips us up, or we get hooked and caught in certain ways, and it leads to suffering. So then, and sometimes it's actually worth consciously paying attention to. You know, one notices a particular train of thought, and then sort of start looking at it, you know, how did I end up there? And then consciously starting to track it back a bit and see, well, what, because usually we start thinking about something, but that is usually, it's like an end product of a series of associations, memories, and proliferations that we haven't really noticed. But then to sort of consciously to pay attention, just as an exercise. If you do that all the time, you just tire yourself out. But it's kind of a salutary exercise in sort of recognizing that tendency of the mind to, you know, just, because that's the function of the mind, is to know, to recognize, to associate. That's the function of memory, thought. But then it's usually, one is usually unrecognized and out of control. So then just giving it some conscious attention to recognize, oh, actually I was thinking of such and such, and then actually that came from this was triggered by this memory and then this association, and somebody said this, and then it ran its course in a particular direction. So but it's just interesting to sort of, well, where did that thought come from, and it helps us to how do you say, undermine the assumption of solidity and kind of the almost like, you know, because I thought it was real and true, but you know, it's not, it's just this offset random stuff popping up all the time. So it's just learning how to question it from time to time. So I think that's a helpful exercise. Okay, and another quote or teaching that is titled "A Snake in the House." Over the years, many Western lay people came to stay at Wat Bopong, the Sajan Chah's monastery. A large number arrived without any intention of becoming monks or nuns, but simply with a wish to meet and receive teachings from Lopo, and to participate for some time in the life of the monastic community. Usually, Lumpa would delegate basic teaching duties to a senior Western monk, but every now and again, he would give a Dhamma talk to the lay guests or answer their questions. It is sometimes alleged that monks are dismissive of lay practice and that great masters reserve the most profound teachings for those who have made a commitment to monastic life. This was not the case with Lumpa. Western lay guests with a sincere interest in practice energized him. Indeed, monks would become excited if they knew that Lumpa was going to give a Dhamma talk to the foreign lay guests because of the profundity of the Dhamma that they might expect to hear. One talk, subsequently published as Living with the Cobra, gives a good idea of the flavor of these teachings. In it, Lumpa compared mental states, both positive and negative, to poisonous snakes. Identifying with a mental state, he said, was like letting yourself be bitten by a cobra. The separation from the truth of things that results from that identification is like death from the cobra's poison. It's a quote. All mental states are like cobras. If nothing obstructs their path, they just glide along their way. Even though they possess venom, it's inside them. They're of no danger to us as long as we don't go near them. They just do what cobras naturally do. Intelligent people let go of attachment to everything, both good and bad. They let go of both what they like and what they dislike. It's as if we were to release a cobra from captivity. It would slither away, taking its poison with it. And that is the way we release mental states. We release the good and bad with an awareness of their nature. We don't touch them, don't take hold of them, because we don't want anything. We don't want good or bad, heavy or light, pleasure or pain. A conclusion is reached, and lucid calm is firmly established. He taught that the path of practice was founded on the development of mindfulness and alertness. When these two factors were mature, the wisdom faculty would arise naturally, and meditators would then be wakeful day and night. Practitioners would be close to the Buddha at all times. The term, arising of wisdom, means that through clearly seeing how all phenomena arise and fall according to causes and conditions, meditators abandon attachment to them as self or adjuncts of self. Quote, when things arise, we know. When they cease, we know. When there is happiness, we know. And when there is unhappiness, we know. Once we know, we don't take possession of that happiness or unhappiness. When there is no sense of possession of those feelings, then all that remains is the simple process of arising and ceasing. You let it follow its natural course because there's nothing there worth attaching to. At this time, Lumpa had been reading Zen Buddhist texts and he gave his own view on the relationship between Nibbana and Samsara, thus discussed in them. The Buddha said that Nibbana is cessation. Where does that cessation take place? Well, it's like a fire. It's extinguished wherever it springs up, wherever it's burning. You cool something at the point where it's hot. It's the same with Nibbana and Samsara. They lie in the same place. The Buddha taught us to put out the fire of Samsara, that is inner turmoil. Bringing inner turmoil to cessation is called putting out the fire. External fires are hot, and when they've been put out, there is coolness. The inner heat of greed, hatred, and delusion are also fires. Think about it. When sexual desire arises in the mind, it's hot, isn't it? If anger arises, it's hot. If delusion arises, it's hot. It's this heat which the Buddha called the fires. When fires spring up, there is heat. When they are extinguished, there is coolness. Nibbana is the state that cools the heat. The Buddha called it peace, the cessation of the wheel of birth and death. Then at the end of the discourse, Lumpa descended from the exalted level in which he had been dwelling to address some warm personal words to the elderly English woman who was the recipient of the talk. When you first arrived, you cried. When I saw your tears, I felt happy. Why was that? Because I knew you were going to be studying the true Dhamma. If no tears flow, then you won't see the Dhamma. Because the fluid in tears is bad stuff. You have to let it all out before you can feel at ease. So please take this Dhamma away with you and put it into practice. Practice in order to transcend suffering. Die before death and be peaceful and at ease. I thought I would read a few accounts that lay people had of their meeting with meetings with Ajahn Chah. This one is Pabuapa. In Thailand, monasteries have always been the place that people can go to seek respite when their life goes wrong. Many people go to monasteries with a superstitious belief that a particular ceremony or offering to the Sangha will offset their bad fortune. But many who went to see Lumpa desired advice and wise reflections. He once joked, "Living here is like living in a garage. Anyone who has something wrong with them, or with their children, or with their wife or husband, comes to give it to me to sort out. Just like someone whose car is broken down, pushes it into the garage and gives it to the mechanic." The Buddha called separation from a loved one a messenger of the Dhamma. In other words, the suffering caused by such separation wakes people up to the truths of life that they have formerly been able to ignore, but can do so no longer. One of Lumpa's most devoted disciples, Pabuapa, first made his way to Wat Bapong during a period of inconsolable grief. And this quote from Pabuapa: "When I got back from the war, I married a girl from Na Sum. We had a couple of kids and we were happy. Then the younger one died. My wife and I were overwhelmed with grief. I missed that child so much I couldn't eat or sleep. I was sad, but life went on. Now, though, I felt as if I was just drifting along aimlessly. I couldn't shake off my depression." At that time, Lumpa had been at Wat Bapong for 2 or 3 years. A neighbor of mine saw how much I was suffering and suggested that I go to see him. He said he might be able to help me get over it, and I went to pay respects to Lumpa and told him my story. He told me that everyone in the world has to die sooner or later. There isn't a single village, a single house, where there's never been a death. Even in monasteries, monks and novices die. Lumpa told Pabuapa that he too must die, and perhaps in no long time. Given that his time in the world was limited, endlessly grieving and lamenting for the departed was helpful to no one. Wise people think of the uncertain time remaining to them and find renewed meaning in their life through devotion to goodness and virtue. It is probable that Pabuapa had heard similar words from well-wishers many times before and had been untouched by them. But somehow, when they were spoken by Lumpa, it seemed to him that he heard them for the first time, and the truth of them struck him forcibly. He said that me and my wife should work together to do whatever was of true benefit to ourselves and others, We should establish ourselves in right livelihood and steadily cultivate goodness and virtue as a supporting condition and provision for the future. As I listened to Lumpa's teaching, I found myself agreeing with everything he said. It was the turning point, and it made me enjoy listening to Dhamma. I started to nip off to see him more often. I learned many things, and my faith and respect in him grew and grew. Lumpa gave me jobs to do, helping to clear paths, cutting grass. I felt very proud to be his trusted helper. My happiness returned. I think that's a sense it might have been quite ordinary what he said, but it's oftentimes in how it's said. Somebody like Lopa Cha, the kind of solicitous quality of his addressing him, and care, compassion, those are have an effect, and I think and similar to the question that was asked before, dealing with how do you deal with terminal patient people who are and oftentimes it's really taking the time to establish one's own sense of groundedness, clarity, well-being, compassion, and then seeing what comes up and addressing from that. Pabuapa is actually, shrine at Wat Nanachat, the old one, the plinth that the Buddhas were on, that's Pabuapa. He learned how to do cement work and got really good at it. I think he did the bell tower at Wat Bapong as well.
The original shrine,
Yeah, original shrine, yes. Yeah, in the old sala. Next is a story of Pa'am, who in the film clip there was a, people wouldn't have known, but I knew, it was a picture of him. He was sitting meditating. A layman was there. He was somebody who had a real doubt about keeping precepts and how to have right livelihood for living in the world, and Ajahn Chah he'd said, well, you don't, especially for village people and farmers, you lived on, in terms of eating, you fished, you trapped birds, you caught frogs. I mean, anything that moved that was your dinner. And so then, how are we supposed to keep the precepts? And Ajahn Chah said, there's many different livelihoods. And he said, if you really want to keep precepts, five precepts strictly, then I'll teach you a livelihood. So he taught him herbal, because oftentimes these old monks, old forest monks, were really good herbalists and traditional healers, because one, they had to live out in the forest, and they sort of gain knowledge from other people around, and Ajahn Chah was really, it was fun walking through the forest with Ajahn Chah. He'd point out this plant and this tree and this leaf and what medicinal quality it had, or what you could do with it for as a medicine or a tea. And it was always fun to do that. But anyway, he taught Pa'am, and Pa'am ended up being, when I got to know him, because his home village was the same village that supports Wat Nanachat. It's close to Wat Nanachat. And that's how, that was his livelihood. And in Thailand, a traditional healer would not be, they wouldn't have a fee. You wouldn't ask for payment, but you would do whatever you could to help people, and then people would look after you. And say, so that was how he lived. And he was also ended up being, he would be the person on the lunar observance days who would lead the chanting or ask for the precepts. So, very faithful. Also very stubborn, as we will see in this story. Some people were impressed by Lumpa's teachings, but were too proud and stubborn to accept them without a fight. One such man was the herbalist Pa'am, who argued with Lumpa until he lost consciousness. And this is Pa'am speaking. Before I came to revere Lumpa, I argued with him for 4 days and nights. During the days, I was helping him plant a row of bamboos around the perimeter of the monastery. Night times, I'd carry on disputing with him right through to dawn. I'd say something like, "If the rice is my rice and the flour is my flour, how can it be bad karma to make it into booze?" And he'd reply, "You've got a knife, you can use the sharp side to kill and destroy, or you can use it to prepare food. The knife is your knife, but if you bring the spine down on top of your head, how does it feel?" So anyway, we argued for 4 days and nights. On the fourth day at noon, I felt dizzy and I fainted. Lumpa came to see what was wrong. I said, "I don't know, everything's gone dark. I can't see anything." Lumpa took me by the hand and led me to the mango grove. Then he rang the bell. There were about six monks in the monastery at that time. He told them to bring a mat and pillow for me to lie on. Then he told them to put 4 water jars to the north of me and 2 to the south and fill them up to the brim. I don't know how long I lay there before I regained consciousness. When I tried to retrace my movements, the last thing I could remember was that I'd been at the Dhamma Hall. So what was I doing in the mango grove? I turned to the west, all confused, and then looked about me. At that moment, I heard Lumpa's voice calling me from behind my head. "Pa'am, Pa'am." I twisted my head back and saw him sitting cross-legged on a bamboo platform, watching over me. He said, "That's what happens when you contend with a monk teaching the Dhamma. You argued all night, you argued all day, 4 days and 4 nights. It's not possible to defeat the Dhamma, you know, and that's why you fainted." I was starting to feel better. Water vapor is a folk remedy for reviving people when they fainted, and it was making me feel cool, comfortable, and refreshed. When I look back now on what happened, I see that I had it all wrong. Lumpa said that someone who lives in a high place is capable of seeing a person who is below him, but someone who lives in a low place can't see someone who is higher. I reflected on that. He was right. So for the one thinks of the that say being in a Buddhist culture, then they just accept what you teach and say. It's not always the case.
But in a sense, he also had wisdom in terms of trying
Yeah. Yeah, no, he's... certainly that aspect of trying everything and trying everything out, so trying to figure it out. Well, there's also another person from Bangor who was a famous person who would always go and argue with Lumpa in the story. It was Lumpa Nupi. Nupi. Yeah, rat ghost. Yeah. Because there's Nudi and Nupi. So is there like two? Ponu is it's a. Nu is a, either a mouse or a rat. It's not a pejorative. It's just sort of a nickname. And there's like Nupi is rat ghost, and Nudi is good rat. Ponudi ended up being the accountant and steward of the monastery. So one day, a certain scientist came to visit Lumpa. Speaking as someone who had practiced meditation and felt qualified to make a comparison, he was of the opinion that as a means of realizing the truth of things, science offered a path that was more effective and more verifiable than Buddhist training. Lumpa was unimpressed. "Don't you think it's possible," he asked, "that you're putting forth this claim without a full knowledge of the results of Buddhist training?" He gave two similes. It was like a man putting one short arm down a hole who concludes that the hole only goes as far as his arm. It was like a short-sighted man who concludes that there are no such things as airplanes in the sky because he's never seen one. On other occasions, he spoke of the study of Buddhist teachings as being the keystone for the study of all other academic subjects, including science. Without Buddhist wisdom, study of any other subject might lead to as many drawbacks for human well-being as advantages. Supported by Buddhist wisdom, drawbacks would be minimized and advantages maximized. At a time when education based on Western models was being promoted as the great panacea for Thai society, certificates and university degrees conferred great status. Lumpa would try to puncture an uncritical belief that book learning was in itself an invariably good thing. It's a quote. "Some people study so much that they become stupid. Impossible to talk to. When they go up high, it's too high. And when they come down low, it's too low. They never see the middle way. Do you think that just because you've studied a lot that now you're smart? Look closely. There's such a thing as being too smart. Strong attachments to views and self-importance arise. You stop seeing other people as human beings. You think that you're more powerful, better, more brilliant. And that way of thinking inevitably leads to contempt for others. Thinking that you're superior to other people leads to nothing but trouble. If you see a peasant farmer and see how you are no different from him, if you see an old person and think that one day you will be like that, if you see children in a state of confusion and you think that you used to be like that, if you bring these things inwards and reflect on yourself in this way, then it's easy to understand the Dhamma." A Thai proverb has it that if held in front of the eye, a single hair can conceal a mountain. Quote, "The teacher says that everything is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and without self. And you say you know. But really, you don't have a clue. With that kind of knowing, you carry on living like a fool, and then you die." Lumpal commented on the reasons he believed people who had high academic qualifications were often hard to teach. He said it was what happened when people studied to accumulate knowledge rather than to remove ignorance and defilement. What they don't realize is that if they have a bachelor's degree, then so do their defilements. If they have a master's degree, then their defilements have got one too. And if they have a doctorate, their defilements do also. He had a biting simile for people who have pursued academic studies to a high level, but having done nothing to educate their higher faculties, are still in thrall to their appetites. And quote, "They're like vultures that fly high in the sky, but when they're hungry, swoop down to gorge on a rotten corpse." This is the story of Papuan. It has been customary since the time of the Buddha for monks to visit lay people as they lay in their deathbed, to help them leave this world for the next in the best possible way. In the last hours of his life, Papuan, one of Lumpa's closest lay disciples, received such a visit. Papuan and his wife Metang were the first lay supporters of Wat Papong to come from the local town of Warin. After spending a rains retreat as a monk, Papuang asked to disrobe, saying that the monastery still lacked many necessities and he wanted to encourage other people from Warin to help him raise the necessary funds. Before long, he had arranged the purchase of a monastery bell, and sometime later, he offered a large grandfather clock for the Dhamma Hall. His greatest joy was to come when he, his family, and friends sponsored the casting of the brass Buddha statue that became the central feature of the Wat Papong Dhamma Hall. After he disrobed, Papuang would still go to the Wat. Every Wat is a Thai word for monastery. Every observance day, keep the 8 precepts and listen to Dhamma. As his health declined in his later years, he offered to donate his skeleton to the monastery after his death as a memento mori and asked Lumpa to pick up his body straight after his death and to prepare the skeleton in the monastery. At the beginning of 1963, when his doctors announced that there was nothing more they could do for him, Papuang's family took him out of the hospital to spend the last days of his life at home. On the 12th of January, Papuang's condition suddenly became much worse. He became unable to speak or open his eyes. He lay in his bed, groaning incessantly. His wife and children sat with him, but were unable to relieve his pain. On the 13th of January, Lumpa, together with Ajahn Jan and a number of other monks, were offered their daily meal in the local army camp. After the meal was over, Lumpa told Colonel Sombun, the commanding officer, that he wanted to visit Papuang and asked if he could arrange a truck. The colonel said he would order a smaller, more comfortable vehicle, but Lumpa repeated that a truck would be fine. Ponu, a lay attendant, asked him whether he was going to visit Papuang or pick up his corpse. Lumpa said, "Pick up the corpse." Ponu was puzzled. "How are you going to do that? He's still alive. Do you think his family would just give him to you? He said to pick his body up after he's dead, didn't he?" Lumpa was silent for a moment and then he said, "Alive or dead, we're picking him up today." Before turning to Ajahn Jan, "Let's go. Papuang is waiting." It was 12:45 p.m. when they arrived at Papuang's house and found him lying on his bed surrounded by his family. Lumpa sat down on the bed looking at the dying man for a few moments. He stroked his face gently, calling him, "Papuang, Papuang." After some time, Papuang opened his eyes and turned his head towards Lumpa. "Papuang, do you know who I am?" Papuang nodded his head and looked at Lumpa. While groaning sounds still came from his mouth, tears started to flow down his cheeks. Lumpa put his hand on the old man's forehead and started to speak to him in a gentle but firm voice. "Papuang, you're a practitioner. You've been fighting this for a long time. When it's time for death to take your life, let it go. It belongs to death anyway. Why are you so possessive of it? You borrowed something, and now you've got to return it. Keep the sound inside. Why are you letting it out?" As Lumpa finished speaking, Papuang's groaning immediately ceased. Lumpa continued, "The body is impermanent and unreliable. It's not beautiful. It's old. You've used it for a long time. Go and look for a new body in that place that you saw in your vision when you were a monk." All this time, Lumpa was stroking Papuang's face. He turned to Colonel Sombun. "Lumpa, what time is it?" Colonel Sombun, 12:55, sir." Lumpa, "Another 5 minutes and he'll be gone." Lumpa kept stroking Papuang's face. At exactly 1 p.m., the dying man's eyes drooped and closed. Papuang had died at peace.
Ordinary for the monks, the Sangha, to be present at most of the important transitions in life, or for those transitions to be brought to the monastics as a seeking of blessings. But that death is one that I think is particularly important, and to have that framework of the Dhamma and of Buddha Dhamma and Sangha as a perspective and framework within that dying process. And we all die, and being able to have that kind of foundation to approach that with. Okay, there's been a few stories. Any questions? Yeah.
Yeah, there's been a lot of stories surrounding death. And I myself have been thinking about this a lot lately because a friend of mine, her son had a battle with cancer, and he made it through, but it was the type that a lot of people don't make it through. And, and she really surprised herself in her ability as going through this, for him to teach her a lot of things and for her to become very accepting of what could very possibly happen. And it got me thinking a lot about the people that are still alive in my life. And I have a sibling that suffers with an addiction. And just wondering, what is the best way to navigate the people that we love that have unskillful behaviors, but we don't want to cut them out of our lives? Mm-hmm. You know, what is the best way to navigate that?
Well, I mean, there's
There's unskillful and there's unskillful. You know, in the sense that some things you have to be alert to so that you don't get entangled in that unskillfulness. But particularly, I mean, it's really, you know, say, yeah, there are people who are family, friends, who are engaged in what's unskillful. But it's important to make a separation between the unskillful action and the person, so that you want to be supporting the person, but not the action. And sometimes that, you know, requires a sense of patience, a sense of kindness. Sometimes it takes a truthfulness to say, you know, this is really harmful. But not in a, and it's important, if it's going to say something like that, it doesn't have weight if it is said out of anger or aversion. But it has weight when it's said with love and concern. And it may or may not land, or it may land and you don't know when it's going to take root. So that, you don't want to be cutting the person out, but you know the actual actions are you don't want to be encouraging that person in unskillful action. Yes. You got the window behind you. Right? You can't see anything.
It's my understanding that there's a duty in regards to the first noble truth to understand suffering. But how do you do that other than not trying to pull away from it? What is that? What's it like to work with that?
Oh, it's miserable. I think so. You know, so much of the time we're afraid of suffering. But it's also important to sort of recognize that one is the like dukkha is so nuanced as a. I mean, it's oftentimes translated as suffering, but it's just so nuanced as to its experience in terms of, you know, dis-ease, dissatisfaction, discontent, stress, and the way that we tend to deal with it is try to get away from it. And there's like the, in the Buddhist teachings, there's these teachings that point to the universal characteristics of things, of the world, and that anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self. But those characteristics tend to be covered obscured by certain, say, like impermanence or change or uncertainty is masked by continuity. There's an apparent continuity, and that tends to sort of mask. And we keep finding ways to maintain that continuity so that we don't recognize impermanence. And dukkha or suffering is masked
because of our, what's, I mean, in the Pali, it's sort of the Iriya bone. It's sort of like we keep changing posture in the sense that whether it's a physical posture or an emotional posture, a mental posture, we keep moving. You know, if we keep ourselves as moving targets, it won't get us. You know, it's not true. but it keeps us moving. It keeps us busy anyway. So that sense of being willing to know the experience of dis-ease, or to know fully. The word that the Buddha uses is Saint Parinya, which means like having full knowledge, full understanding of dukkha is your window into understanding the cause. Because until we see the experience clearly, then we don't get much of an inkling as where it's coming from. Because we tend to divert blame, or we distract ourselves, or we keep ourselves busy, or whatever. So we don't actually see dukkha clearly. So that willingness to know this clearly, to experience it, to indulge in it or wallow in it. But it's a sense of clear knowing, full understanding. Oh, this is what it is. It's like this. And then we get a window onto, say, what it, oh, it's just this much. It's not, because usually it's just this much. It's no big deal. Then it's not, we can really investigate it and relinquish it. And particularly relinquishing the cause. Just recognizing that again, Ajahn Chah's emphasis of the that meditation practice, development of Dhamma practice, is really for everybody, and. Dhamma practice wasn't some esoteric pursuit suitable only for monastics. It was a matter of developing wisdom about your own life. Sometimes lay people would come to him and say that they couldn't meditate because they were illiterate. And his response, "Why do you need to be literate? You put your hand in the fire and it's hot. You put it in water and it's cool. Do you understand that much? If you do, you can cultivate the Dhamma." The word bhavana is monk's language. In ordinary language, we say consider or reflect. Just know whatever arises in your mind. When anger arises in your mind, are you aware of it? Greed arises.
Are you aware of it? What's it like to be angry? What's it like to feel desire? Just keep looking at that. What else did you think it was about? If you can move and breathe, if you know the difference between hot and cold and between liking and disliking, then you can still practice the Dhamma, because the Dhamma appears in this very body and mind. Don't think the Dhamma is a long way away. It's with us. It's about nothing else but us. Just look. One moment you're happy, and the next you're sad. One moment you're satisfied, and the next you're not. Then you're getting angry with that person, hating this one. That's all Dhamma. Nothing belongs to us. We don't even belong to us. In the end, we disintegrate according to the law of impermanence. Head hair, body hair, nails, teeth, and skin. If you contemplate these things well, then you will see them in their true light. These things are not ours, because they're not under our control. The whole body is the same. When it wants to hurt, it hurts. When it wants to get old, it gets old. And when it wants to die, then it dies. It never listens to us about any of it. When you get a headache or a stomach ache, has your body ever asked your permission first? And sometimes these are, and you think, well, it is quite ordinary. But then when you really start internalizing that and reflecting on this, yeah, the ordinariness of just say, yeah, aging, sickness, death, these are incredibly ordinary on a certain level, mundane realities, but they're pointing to these truths that we can see more and more clearly, and then relinquish our desire and attachment toward body, mind, world, and they're. What comes popping into mind is a memory of Ajahn Chah talking about when he was growing up and into as an adult, then he had a lot of trouble with his teeth. There's an old picture when he was still fairly young. And you can see his mouth, his mouth is swollen. His gums are all swollen. He had terrible trouble with his teeth, and sometimes he wouldn't be able to eat for days because, and then some of his teeth would fall out, and after a while he had them all pulled out. And he said, and he was just so fed up with his teeth that were always aching and troublesome for him. And then he's talking about it. He says, to getting them pulled out would be a really good thing. I'll be able to not have to experience this sort of pain and frustration of having these painful teeth. And he says, but then I got these false teeth, and I got them, and I was really, really happy to get those false teeth. But think about how much fun that is. You just go around with two coconut shells in your mouth. That's no fun either. So it's just this pervasive. There's always some sort of dukkha. Any questions? There's one. I'm going to do one more reading to wrap it up, to wrap up the day. So before we wrap it up, any questions? Yes, John.
I have kind of a question on maybe a lighter side. Like, I want to ask you if one continues to practice, it's sort of like and succeeds at some level. It's sort of like everything becomes downtime. You know, people talk about having to have downtime, like a relief from, you know, going on vacation, go to the ball game, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you said, yes, that's really sort of what it's like. Is that the case, you know? In a sense, because, you know, a lot of, I don't know, particularly an American thing, you know, but maybe not, but people look to, including myself, you know, well, I'll listen to the Giants that I was really telling you to go about that. Anyway, you know, stuff like that, like kind of lighter things in life and that.
Even at a
deeper level, at a much deeper level, if you succeed in this practice, maybe that becomes less of a need or less of a kind of phony refuge. You bear your life very, very gently and with a lot of humor and a lot of grace. And the longer people are in the practice, the more I see that exhibit. So it's because a lot of what we talked about today is so kind of serious and self-investigative and kind of slog in some sense at times.
Well, I think that's, yeah, I think it's a lot of it is how we pick it up.
Yeah.
But it's because we reflect on these quote-unquote serious things that we can hold things lightly.
Yeah.
Because if you take everything really seriously, it's just oppressive. So you want to be able to view things, and just like that, like when Ajahn Chah is talking about his experience with his false teeth. I mean, he was laughing, and that's these sort of ordinary things. And certainly, it doesn't preclude, engaging in. There's kind of distractions and entertainments that say are very ordinary within the world, and it's quite innocent, really. It's also what's the mind making of it? You know, how much is there that I have to have of it? And so that's more the critical issue. How much do I have to have this particular event in my life, or this distraction, or this enjoyment? Can I enjoy something because it's enjoyable? It's like one of the examples I like to give of a meal reflection on the, we're eating, not for fun, not for pleasure, not for fattening, not for beautification, so you really have to be restrained in eating. But then also the Buddha, the other side of the coin is, and like one of the things the Buddha, not just more than encouraged. I mean, he kind of, almost mandated, say, the use of toothwoods to clean your teeth, look after your things. And then he's talking about one of the benefits. I mean, one is, of course, your teeth are healthy and your gums are healthy. And then he said, food tastes better. I thought you weren't supposed to enjoy stuff, but it's natural. It's a natural enjoyment, or taking enjoyment especially in nature and the world, because it really doesn't stimulate the mind or in an unwholesome way, or you don't proliferate around it, and certainly in the in the world, and then there's all sorts of avenues of, very simple enjoyment that are quite, I think quite appropriate.
So this story kind of gives a sense that sort of the northeastern Thailand Isan culture was sort of the soil that sort of supports the living tradition.
Yes.
And then, so I'm just wondering, like, today we're trying to transplant Buddhism to the West. And so are there some kind of cultural attitudes or ingredients that could be helpful for lay people, in addition to the key things, like sila, right view, and other sort of, you know, austerity, or is it some kind of...
No, I think one of the main things to, you know, in terms of looking at a long-term basis, I think one of the things that would be in terms of transplanting or encouraging that would really help the putting down the roots of say Buddhist practice, generosity. It's the opportunity of giving and sharing and helping, being of service. All of those are things that don't get a lot of airplay for the when we think of Buddhist practice. And and so there's already a real sincere interest in the Buddhist teachings and in the cultivation of meditation, but sometimes that can get kind of arid or dry, and or even around precepts, because we can have a like one of the things in Thailand of you know, people keep the precepts because they see the benefit of it, as opposed to it being something that you've got this, you know, cloud of guilt over you, that if I don't keep those precepts, man, there's something that's going to happen bad. But I think underlying all of that, there's a nurturing of generosity and sharing and giving that would be that brings a lot of joy, and I think that's one of the things that is important, because even when we approach precepts or meditation or the teachings, that we approach it from a place of giving to it. Like, how do we make our mind peaceful? It's like being able to give the mind to its object.